Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Dave Copeland, author of Sustainable Rails. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate being back.
Yeah, thanks for being here. It's always really good to talk with you. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I've previously worked at Stitch Fix for many years, and I took some time off, and now I'm working at a mental health startup. So, you know, starting from zero, building up a business and a team from nothing, which is super exciting. So that's my very, very brief bio, but I think that kind of covers it.
And you and I today are going to be talking about organizing Rails code, which is like obviously a super broad topic. And maybe to contextualize this a little bit, maybe you and I can both share our experience a little bit of like how long we've been doing Rails and maybe why we even want to talk about this. So for me, I've been doing Rails since like 2011, so this year it'll be like 10 years of Rails for me.
Nice.
And I've seen a lot of different Rails projects, and frankly, most of them just like color inside the lines that Rails gives you, which is great for the first like few months of the project, I might say. But then as your app starts to gain any kind of real complexity, you're going to have to use your own, you're going to have to add your own structures in order for it to really continue to be understandable. So that's kind of my brief take on it. How about you?
Yeah, so I think I started with Rails around the same time as you, 2011. I got a job at Living Social. The team was about 200 people at the time. So I came into what was a huge Rails monolith. And I knew Rails, but I hadn't done it at a real job before. So it was my first exposure. And it was rough. I mean, their user class was so big. And it just wasn't really managed. And I think it's because people just didn't know what to do. And so they're like, well, just do what Rails says to do. So then after that, I worked at Stitch Fix, and I started there much earlier. So I got to create most of the apps that were there at the beginning. And myself and another developer who had worked at ModCloth, he had a similar experience to me at Living Social. We were like, okay, let's try to not do that. And so our strategy was, let's not put anything in the active records other than like the configuration for like, you know, the database and stuff. And we'll just put everything else in just some other class. We'll just call it a service and just sort of leave it at that. And then, so we did that for, you know, and I was there for 6.5 years, and I got to see like what worked and what didn't, but it was better. I think, but you know, still complicated.
Yeah. Sure. For me in my early Rails projects, I kind of like thought everything had to go into active record classes, or that it should. And then I read this blog post by Steve Klabnik that pointed out that like, hey, you don't have to put all your models in active record models. You can still have a model that's just a Ruby class. It doesn't have to be an active record model. And a light bulb went on for me at that moment. And so I started doing things that way. And I still do things that way now. I suspect you and I, Dave, can have like a good-natured difference in this particular topic. I've written rants against so-called service objects in the past, partly because it's an ill-defined term. It means different things to different people.
Yeah.
And so it's tough to like advocate for an idea if the idea isn't even a very specific one. And I'm curious to hear your specific conception of what a service object is. But what I hope people realize is that you can have just a plain old object, and like objects are fine. Like you can do a lot with just I think maybe the reason people do this is because with Rails you have controllers, and so like there's this concept that Rails gives you, and you put things in this slot, and then you have models, that's another slot where you put things, and all these different things, routes, whatever. And then you have this other code, and it's like, wait a second, I don't have a slot to put this stuff in. Well, I'll make a slot and I'll call it service objects. So that's kind of my brief rant about that, but I'm curious to hear your opinion.
Yeah, so before Living Social, I was did a ton of Java, did a ton of like J2EE and Spring framework. I don't know if you're familiar with any of that stuff, but the way you make a Spring framework app is like it's heavily dependency injection. So you write your code, and if your class needs access to other classes, it'll have like a setter. So if I'm like a credit card charger and I need access to a like payment method, I'd have a set payment method, you know, on me. And
hang
then,
on a second. I'm sorry. Let me make sure that I can follow. So first of all, dependency injection, for anybody who's not familiar, that's like where you pass in an object as an argument to instantiate another object so that you don't have that tight coupling of those two objects. So I get that. I don't think I really understood the part you said next after that.
I was trying to give an example of what you just sort of summarized much better. But like if I'm in a class that's like credit card charger, and that credit card charger needs access to a payment method to do its work, it will have a set payment method that the dependency injection framework will sort of give to you. So I don't have to create this payment method. I choose a bad name for the class, payment method. Anyway, the point is when you write the Spring application, like you have all of these highly decoupled classes. Everything is called a service. That's what Spring calls it. Everything is injected. You're not ever calling constructors on anything because the framework kind of handles it. So that was my sort of like background, and that has pluses and minuses. But when I came to Rails, it's like there's none of that, right? Absolutely. You do not really write Rails code like that. But I definitely had this conception of like a service in my mind, which is like the thing where the business logic goes. So like wherever that logic lives, it's not in the database, it's not in the controller, it's in the quote unquote service. And how that service is defined and the structure of it is unclear, right? Like it kind of depends or is not well defined. And I think that trips people up too, because it's like you said, Rails gives you all these places to put stuff. And so you're used to being told this is exactly the shape of the thing that goes here. And then the business logic, well, it's like Rails can't possibly tell you how to do that. So it's a little unclear. So then you have a bunch of decisions to make, and it's a lot harder. But that's kind of, I don't know, that's kind of how I kind of came from all this and when I think about it, which is not really clarifying your conception, your problems with the service object. It's like, yep, it's unclear.
Yeah, and to be more precise about my beef with service objects, it's not necessarily that I have a problem with the concept of a service object, whatever exactly that is. The problem I have is junior developers cargo culting the concept without really understanding it. Because it's one thing to say, okay, this is what OOP is all about. I understand this, this, and this. And then, okay, here's what service objects are all about, and I understand these pros and cons and stuff like that. Okay, I'm looking at both for this particular use case. I'm going to choose service objects. That, to me, is completely valid. The issue is when people choose service objects out of complete ignorance of just regular old OOP. That makes me a little bit frustrated to see, because it's like, guys, we have this thing already. It's called object-oriented programming. We don't have to use all these service objects. But that's not necessarily a criticism of service objects in all cases, because I could imagine I could imagine scenarios where it makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like what colors your views on that is not obviously cargo culting, because other people in the Rails world tell you to do that. You kind of carried over some concepts from your previous experience with Java.
Yeah, and like the OO thing is interesting because if you look at the parts of Rails, not much of it is really that OO, right? Like a controller is super weird. You never create a controller. You never call the methods. The methods have no input or output, and yet, you know, it works pretty well. Even active records, right? Like for me, when I was first learning OO, it's like, oh, you get this encapsulation of private data. But like active records don't do that at all. And that's fine. Like they work great, but they're not encapsulating anything really. And so you look at the different parts of Rails and like they're not really that OO. So then I'm like, well, why is my stuff have to be beholden to this like OO thing when like the rest of Rails isn't? Rails is like super pragmatic, right? Like controllers is a great example. We're going to set instance variables and those are going to get copied to your view. It sounds super sketchy, but it works pretty well, but not OO, right? Breaks encapsulation horribly, but it works. So
yeah, I would certainly agree with you that controllers are weird and they're not really all that OO. And that's probably what makes it all the more unnatural for people to decide to use OO in their Rails projects.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it took me a long time, and I'm still working on like pushing my imagination to like conceive of objects that make sense in my project, because I think that's a lot of what it is like back when I used to just shove everything into active record models, what I was suffering from was one, an ignorance that I could put things outside of the active record models, but then also just a failure of imagination where I would see some code, and today where I might see 20 lines of code and see it and say, oh, I see, this is doing stuff related to charges. I should have an object called a charge. And that's a bad example because that's like pretty easy to conceive of. But
right.
Today I find myself, I'll look up maybe an example in some of my code in a minute. But the kinds of objects you might come up with are a lot of times very non-obvious. And I think even though Rails has some weird OO stuff going on, you can look to Rails for some objects that might not seem super obvious. Like maybe you can help me think of some, Dave, but there's like active record collection. I think there's like a class called that or something like that.
Right.
But a lot of the Rails classes, they're like three words long or something like that.
And
a lot of these like OOP examples on blog posts and books and stuff, you create classes called like animal and dog and cat and stuff like that.
And that's not how it works in a real application.
Right. And Avdi Grimm said something that I thought was a really good point. He said that object modeling it's a model, not a simulation. And so like examples that have like engine and wheel and door and stuff for modeling a car, like that's not realistic. You're not going to have that kind of stuff. You're going to have like the IT concerns around like selling a vehicle and keeping inventory and stuff like that.
Yeah, totally. Well, and what gets really complicated is like you can start off with like models that have names of things that like the non-engineers also use those words, right? Like, you know, a charge or an invoice. Like those are things that like a regular person knows. But then when you start building the code out, it tends to get complicated. You need to separate those into sub concepts, right? So like, what we've been doing where I work is like at the resource layer, that's where we have the names of all of the things, and there's a ton of them and they have really weird things. So there's this notion of like a deposit that you've paid a deposit for the service. But then we need to be able to refund deposits, but not every deposit is refundable. So we made a refundable deposit, which allows us to organize the code and it's specific, but like no user is going to say refundable deposit. Like it's a little esoteric for them. And so you have to, it can be really hard to kind of find that balance of like modeling the domain than the words that users use versus not having like 10 objects that have all the code in them because the users only use 10 words, if that kind of made sense.
Yeah, yeah. That's a perfect example. What was it? Refundable deposit?
Refundable.
Yeah, yeah. That's a perfect example. And like I'm looking at my code right now and there's some examples. Okay, I have to give just a little bit of domain context for this one, but like, when somebody gets a surgery, because this is a medical application, when somebody gets a surgery for some period of time after the surgery, they're in what's called a global period. And during that period, the insurance rules work a little bit differently. Okay. And so I have something called a global period, and then I also have something called a global period query. And I'm going to look real quick because I'm curious if either of these inherit from active record or what the deal is. Okay, yeah, neither of these inherit from active record. These are both just poros.
Yeah, and that's our refundable deposit is too. And so to bring it back to the services, we have a service, and I forget the name of it. The names of our services are probably super offensive to a lot of people because they're like deposit refunder or something like that. But the way that we have it organized is we have this service that then we'll use the deposit active record to figure out which of those deposits are refundable, transform them into a refundable deposit, and return an array of that. And so then in your controller, you're just dealing with this refundable deposit, which is like a, it's like an active model, right? It doesn't have any behavior, it just has a bunch of data we can, you know, send off to the view. But that's been the sort of, I don't know, way we've organized things, and it so far works.
Okay. Now I'll ask you a question based on like how I might imagine doing that. So I might be inclined, without knowing anything about what the actual details are, to create an object called like a refund or something like that, or a deposit refund if it needs to be more specific. And then I might have a create method on deposit refund or something like that, which does the business of bringing that into existence. What do you see as like the pros and cons of doing it that way versus kind of, it sounds like you're accomplishing that same thing with some sort of service.
Yeah. And so like in what I described, the service has the logic of stuff, but it doesn't have any internal state. And then this refundable deposit has no logic, but it has all the state. So they're in separate classes. And so if I understand what you're talking about, it's sort of more OO in so much as it's kind of combining those things, right? Like, and I think that that makes a lot of sense. And I would love to know what a code base is like that does that, right? That uses lots of models that aren't active records, but then each model kind of looks like what active, like there's parts of active record that are like create, destroy, find, right? Those seem logical, right? So I could see it being logical to have refundable deposit dot find, and that finds all the refundable deposits, whatever that means. We didn't end up doing it that way, but I could see that being a nice way to manage this versus dumping it all into active records.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if the example that I invoked just now of like your service versus my object, it might be kind of a distinction without a difference, because a person could say legitimately like, okay, if you have a class that's called deposit refund or whatever it is I said, how's that much different from having a deposit refund service and having it have a perform method? And I don't think I could give a great defense of how that's much different, because I think it's actually not much different.
I mean, I guess a difference might be that to understand deposit refunding in this increasingly hypothetical example, in my version, you need to look at the service to get the logic and find the model to look at the data. And in your version that I'm maybe simplifying, it's all in the same class, so you can kind of see it all together.
I don't think so. Oh. I don't think I would put them in the same class, because I think that would like muddy up the concept.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. I will say that like, coming up with names of services is not easy the way that like all of our services are something doer, right? And then they have a method called do something. Like it looks a little redundant and weird, but it's super obvious what's happening when you read the code, I guess, even though it's a lot of extra. It feels verbose, but I don't know.
Yeah, I would be interested to like, it's a little bit hard to talk about it without actually looking at some code. But maybe I look at it in a similar way to the way that I look at like background jobs. I have this belief that like background jobs shouldn't do things. They should only call things. And so like when I see a background job that has like 100 lines of code in it, I usually will look at that and say, okay, well, I see what's happening here is really you're doing blah, blah, blah. And so I'll put that in some kind of one or more objects. Because I think a big difference is, okay, here's maybe it. I was thinking about this the other day and I just remembered. There's this whole difference between imperative and declarative programming. So like imperative saying step by step what to do versus declarative saying these things exist, and then wherever you want to actually accomplish something, you kind of just chain those things together or whatever. And to me, service objects seem more the imperative style, and just regular old OOP seems more the declarative style, and I prefer the declarative style. Do you think that is like an accurate mapping of those ideas, that like service objects tend to be declarative and objects tend to, sorry, other way around, service objects tend to be imperative, objects tend to be declarative?
Yeah, I mean, the service objects that like we wrote at Stitch Fix and the ones that we're doing at my current job, they're all very procedural, like step by step, like here's what has to happen for this, 1, 2, 3. I would say that the OO dream is exactly what you sort of described, is like, I've got all these things that I'm just going to declare and kind of piece them together. And I do wonder if there's like some aspect of like how people's brains work or what your background is. Cause like my, even farther back from Java, which is not, it's technically OO, but most people write Java in a very procedural way, as I was kind of describing. I did C before that. And, you know, like that's, right, super procedural. Yeah, people don't do a lot of OO and C. So I don't know if that colors my view of like what seems like normal or understandable.
Well, I think procedural is just like more natural in general. Like I wrote much more like if anybody sits down and writes code as like a new programmer, like they're probably going to write procedural code. Nobody's going to like sit down and like invent OOP, because it's actually kind of unnatural. And it requires like, it's funny, like it took me a few years to like feel like I really understood OOP. And then a few years later, I realized that I actually didn't understand OOP back then. But then I'm like, I didn't understand it back then, but I totally do now. And then a few years later, I'm like, oh, wait, I actually still didn't understand it back then, but I do now. And I keep having that like every few years where I feel like, okay, now I really get it. Because it's like... Yeah. It's really like kind of unnatural to learn.
Well, and it's not a clearly defined concept. It's more like, how do you do it in your language, right? So like in Java, there's things you just can't do that you can do in Ruby. And a lot of people that come from Java to Ruby are just incredulous that you can like redefine a method or like dynamically call one. And it's like, but you can. So if you need to, you should, because like it's there. Just because Java doesn't have it doesn't mean that like you can't use it, you know, if it's there. But The other thing, though, to kind of come back a little bit to the procedural and how it's natural for people, one thing I found is like, if there's a problem in like production, like there's some problem with the app, you kind of need to figure out like what is the app doing? And when you look at procedural code, even if it's long, you can figure out what it's doing because it's kind of all right there and you don't have to chase down a lot of abstractions and callbacks and things that are sort of implicitly happening. And I guess, I don't know. I mean, maybe this is just like years of working at an increasingly large, fast moving company, but you tend to have problems and you're like, I need to quickly figure out what's going on in this code. And if it's the harder that is to do, the more annoyed I get. I don't know if that says for everybody, but it's nice when you can understand like what the code is actually doing. And sometimes procedural can be a little easier to figure that out, at least for me. I don't know.
Interesting, because for me, the only point of OOP is to make things more understandable. So let me ask this, like, if you have some procedural code, obviously you're not going to write like 2,000 lines in one method or something like that. So you break it up in some way to make things more understandable. How do you tend to break things up to aid the understanding?
Yeah, private methods is a good go-to. I think you had written a blog post and we exchanged, you know, something on Twitter about that. So I'll use private methods pretty liberally. And then this is the hard part, the step two, is if you start to see things that you're repeating, so like I need this private method, I need that outside of the class, how am I going to get that? Well, maybe that's the time to like extract that to a new object of some kind so that then it can be reused between the two. That's hard to do. You have to kind of know the whole code base, and then there's a point at which no one can know the whole code base, and that becomes probably impossible. But that's been what I've done to do that. And it, you know, seems like it works pretty well, at least on a small to medium kind of scale.
Yeah, it sounds like that part you and I do pretty similar, because that's also what I'll do. Like if there's a chunk of code that's getting too big to be easily understandable, because I think that's the only reason to break up a long chunk of code is because like it's not the fact that it's long in and of itself that's bad. It's that long things tend to be hard to understand. And so you have methods and you have objects, and I tend to break those out into those two things. Here's something I've been
a complicated recipe, right? There's like, okay, here's how to make the sauce on page, 10. But once you've made the sauce, come back here and you can pick up the rest of the recipe, right? Like recipe books, like do that all the time for the exact reasons that you stated.
Yeah, exactly. Like they're not going to lay out all the steps for how to make a bechamel in every single recipe that mentions a bechamel. Right. It's like, no, look at the index for the sauces and there's how to make a bechamel. Something I've been doing, differently recently is this. And the food thing is actually a really good analogy, because like, okay, a bechamel is something that's used in like a lot of different recipes. And so that makes sense to have like an index with some sauces, and you have bechamel in that index along with whatever else. But what if there's a sauce that's only used for one recipe? The old me would have, metaphorically, obviously, the old me would have put that sauce into the index with all the other sauces, even if the sauce was only used for one recipe. But what I started to discover is that like, if you stumble across that stuff, then you start to see like, okay, wait a second, there's this sauce here. I can't think of a sauce that's like uncommonly used. I wish I could extend the analogy even further that way. But you're coming across just this one thing, and you're like, hang on a second, is this like, what is this used by? And obviously you can grep the code base and find that. Right. But like, you might make the mistake of thinking that this is like a general purpose thing when it's only used for like one minor peripheral feature. And so I've started to try to like take those things, whether they're methods or objects or even scopes or something like that, and put it all in like one subdirectory together if I can, so that it's kind of like packaged up and separated from something, from everything else, so that you don't make the mistake of thinking it's like this broad thing.
Yeah, I think scopes are a good example of that, because they're, especially if you're new to Rails or you just, you know, you do what you think you're supposed to, like every database query is a scope in some active record. And then you end up with like a zillion scopes that are used in one place only, or maybe zero places because some code changed and stopped using it, right? And but you think it's this, you think you're cultivating this reusable base of stuff when you need to, like, it's better, I think, to look at the code to see what actually does need to get reused, and then, you know, kind of promote that to a scope if it needs to. So
yeah, there's some aspects of scope that like tickle my programmer brain, which say like, hey, isn't this great? I now have this like general purpose thing where I can do like dot future to get like all the appointments that happen in the future, or like dot past to get everything in the past. And like, it feels really neat to have those abilities. And maybe those two things, like future and past appointments, like that's broad enough to warrant being in the main class, because you really are going to use that all over the place. Yeah. But then like, I found myself starting to add all these scopes, some of which were very narrow purpose, and again, only used in one place, but they were all in this. I ended up extracting all my scopes into a separate file because they were just so numerous. But then I'm like, wait a second, maybe it's not a good idea to have like, because these are different, they're not apples to apples at all. Like the dot future scope is much different from the super specific scope that's only used in one place. And so I've started to take those and move them to live like right inside of the features that they serve.
Yeah, that's what we do too. We use where all over the place. Like to think about like the OO concept of encapsulation, like what if the where method, which lets you write arbitrary SQL, what if that was private to an active record? Well, then, right, you'd have to write a bunch of scopes because only methods of your user class have access to this private where method. But since where is public, I figure we might as well use it. And if I see the same blob of SQL in two places, then yeah, then make a scope, because now you've discovered this reusable concept that you need. But I feel like it's really hard to predict in advance what the reusable concepts are. Like your example, future, sounds like you would probably use it more than once, but like, what if you only need it once? Then you didn't really buy anything by having it as a scope. Because you could make a method called future in some class, some private method called future in some class that does the same thing.
Yeah. You know, I think like for as smart as programmers are, we have these like intellectual weaknesses. And I think one of our common weaknesses is this idea of like building things speculatively.
Yeah.
Like the idea of that dot future scope. It's like, hey, this would be handy in the future if we ever do such and such. And that's like a poisonous way of thinking, because yes, we should think about and plan for the future and anticipate things in the future, but we should only build for the needs of right now.
Yeah.
And I think the reason for that, why is that? I think that's because if you build things for the future, then you end up with things that are like not connected to reality, and not like they're not in the path that is traveled by tests and usage and stuff like that. And so if you have anything that's not covered by tests, then obviously that's a weakness. And you have if you have things, code that's just there that's not actually getting exercised by people using the application, I can't articulate exactly why I think that's bad, but that seems bad, right?
Yeah, because it's not solving a problem that someone has, because it's not being used. You don't actually know if it really works in production, because we all know that we can have amazing tests and then there's bugs in production. And that's how you find them, is putting code in production. But then it's a carrying cost, right? And so like you got to pay a price for that code all day, every day. And then what could your team be doing if they didn't have to pay that carrying cost times however many of them count?
Yeah, I think you nailed it with the cost. As you were talking, I thought like, oh yeah, the reason is because all code has a cost. And if you build things speculatively, then you're paying a cost for something that's not being used. And that's just waste.
Yeah, you're not getting anything back from it. I thought, so at Stitch Fix, I worked on the warehouse software. And so we started scanning barcode. We put barcodes on things and you would scan those into the app and it would do stuff. And so I thought, there's going to be barcodes everywhere. Everything in this warehouse is going to have a barcode on it. We're going to need to scan it. So I'm going to build this really fancy way that you can look at a barcode and figure out what database object or what resource or what thing was scanned. And it was very complicated and had all kinds of like list comprehension, functional programming stuff to like make it like very short lines of code. So I would say while I maintained that code, it was maybe changed once or twice. And then I moved on to other projects and other teams took over that function and they never really had to change it either. And then the day did come when there was barcodes on everywhere. But on that day, the software was like completely different and you didn't have this centralized barcode scanning service that I had thought was surely going to need to exist. And I was just completely wrong. And I just, you know, I was just so sorry to the people that had to maintain this like super complicated, flexible system that like was never needed. So
I certainly have done similar things. And yeah, I think like everything that programmers like us know who have been doing it for a long time, we know these things because we've done it a bad way in the past and we burned ourselves and we're like, oh yeah, that's a bad idea. Don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And it's, I mean, to come back to like these sort of conventions about where code goes and connect it to this sort of experience thing, like it can, you know, this is a little off topic, I suppose, but like it can be hard to be like, look, don't do X versus letting people do X so they can experience the failure and really, really learn it. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, because at the early days of Stitch Fix, we all said, do not put code in active records. Like we said that. There is a bunch of other things that we did not say explicitly, and some people did them and some people didn't. And some people learned the lesson and some people didn't. And so it was just very hard to figure out how to manage this growing code base without being overly authoritarian about saying all the yeses and nos to everything versus letting people experience this failure on their own like I did, which I thought was very valuable. I don't know. I'm getting a little off topic on leadership, I suppose. But
well, I think that is relevant. You know, I read in this psychology book. It mentioned something. It was not a parenting book, but it did mention something about parenting. It said, like, when you tell your kids to do something or not do something, don't appeal to authority, but rather appeal to reason. And I thought that made a lot of sense. And so I try to do that as a parent, but also in like leading a team of developers, it's, you don't want to say, do this because I just know that this is true, and so do it the way I right. say. But yeah. either providing some reasons and like letting them come with you on the journey to arriving at that conclusion, or saying like, hey, if you don't believe me, try it and like we'll see yeah. how it works out. But probably, I don't know, I'm kind of hesitant about that idea, because that might be a slippery slope to allowing a lot of things in, and by the time the pain is apparent, it's too late to reasonably fix it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in any case, I think your point is a good one about like, don't authoritatively say, for example, don't put things in active record, but don't put things in active record because, and maybe let's even talk about that a little bit, because I've shifted to put things in active record by default was my thinking, to now I think by default, don't put things in active record. And can we talk a little bit more about why we think that?
Yeah, so when I was writing this Sustainable Rails book, there's like a part in there that talks about this. And it was, I rewrote that chapter many times, because at first I was like, I just felt like all of my arguments were this sort of appeal to purity. Like, it is just not nice. It is not clean code or whatever to do that, or it's gross, or the class gets big. And all these are like, but why is that a problem? And so where I kind of came down was like, all right, there's going to be some active records that are like really core to your business. Like, user is always a good example. At Stitch Fix, it was shipment. Where I'm at now, it's appointment. You might have similar things. And so objects of that class are used in everything. So if there's a problem in that class, you're going to have a problem everywhere. And so a way to deal with that is like, don't put a lot of complicated stuff in that class. So if your user class just accesses users in a database and that's it, but it's used everywhere. Well, it's pretty safe because it's not going to change. It's pretty stable. There's nothing to it. You don't have to like worry about fixing it and all that. Whereas if everything you could ever do with a user was a method of that class, now you've got something that's really hard to maintain, really complicated. And if it breaks, could potentially break everything in the whole system. So that seems bad. Now, that explanation, I don't think was in my conscious mind the first time I started saying, don't put stuff in active records. Because in that, it was just like, oh, it just feels gross. But I think it was something in me that like knew that was why, but I wasn't consciously aware of it. But I do think that kind of felt like the best explanation that is not some sort of appeal to OO purity or something.
You know, it's funny. I think I saw on Twitter some months ago, like somebody asked Paul Graham why he writes, and his answer to my memory was to figure things out. And I thought that was a really interesting answer, because it's often true that you don't really know what you think until you try to articulate it. And that's totally been my experience, like with writing my blog posts and books and talking with people on this podcast. If you had asked me like 3 years ago what I think about all these certain things, I don't think I really would have been able to intelligently articulate it. But now that I've had to, like, you know, people ask me like, hey, you said you should do such and such thing. Why? And sometimes it forces me to articulate it. And sometimes it forces me to think a little bit deeper. Like when I say something out loud and it sounds really stupid compared to how good it sounded in my head, I'm like, wait a second. Maybe I should adjust that belief, because that doesn't really make complete sense. I think I just took us on a tangent. I forget what the point you even made was. Oh, yeah, you were talking about why not to put things right in active record. That's an interesting reason that I hadn't really thought about. I'll share my reason, which is like, let's take the extreme of just put everything in active record models and nowhere else. You end up with a large class, and just its sheer size makes it hard to understand. But then you also end up with this heterogeneousness of the content of that class. And you have like, there's maybe 20 methods that relate to feature A, but then just one method that relates to feature B. And that's weird because you have this lopsidedness of all these different methods for one feature and just one for another. That's one. And then you might have like, okay. So what they call, mixing levels of abstraction. So you have something that's like fine grained, really nitty gritty details in one method. And then another method has some really high level stuff. Maybe these two methods are about equal size, but they're just at way different levels of abstraction, different levels of granularity. And so that's weird too. So the fact that putting everything in active record results in those situations, that's kind of what drives me to say, don't put them in there by default, put them somewhere else by default. And only if they're like super broad, bring it back into active record.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, if you think about like your active records as your core things where you put your most reusable concepts, then if you end up putting everything in there anyway, you get this append only class where like you can never possibly read and see what's there. So you just add your method to the end. But and I think too, like the need, right? So I was saying before how like active records aren't because they don't really encapsulate anything. Like you can access everything from an instance of an active record. So there's not a lot of technical reason to put methods on the active record because those methods don't have access to anything that you don't already have access to by having an instance of said active record.
So you're talking about like the object's attributes. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And like any methods that you put on there, all the active record methods, like where, find by, all that stuff, it's all public. So if all you need to do is call those methods, there's not a lot of technical reason to put a new method on the active record. And so I think that leads to your point, right? Which is only put things that like sort of logically make sense as a reusable concept. Don't just put everything on there, because if you need access to users' first names, you can get that without writing a method on the user class.
Let me ask you about something else. As an application grows, of course, we'll extract things out of the active record class, or we'll just put things somewhere else. But like if it's something related to a user, and maybe that's a bad example because that's just such a root concept, a user, it's going to be broad. Let's say maybe like I have the concept in my application of an insurance payment. I'm going to have all kinds of stuff related to the insurance payment class, directly related, indirectly related, and stuff like that. I'm going to have to put it somewhere. And so I've started to make heavy use. Well, not started, maybe like a year more ago, I started to do this. I've made heavy use of namespaces, and I found that to be pretty helpful in keeping things structured. Do you use namespaces in your apps at all?
Yeah, the nature of our app is that it integrates with a lot of third parties. So we'll take data out of one thing and send it to another thing. And there's just a lot of that as it just sort of happens. And so we have namespaces for each code that deals with some third party. So like we use Intercom for campaign, you know, email campaigns. So there's an Intercom namespace, and anything that has to do with Intercom goes in there, et cetera, et cetera. Now our code that isn't like that is still in the top level without a namespace. But I had thought of that, and we have started doing that where you start to get this like group of classes that all belong together but don't belong elsewhere, and you wanted to sort of organize them. And I would to make a very long point, I would agree namespaces is a good way to organize things without getting anything too fancy, right? Like I love to find a non-fancy way to do something. I think namespaces are a really good non-fancy way to organize things, because you're just making a directory and putting stuff in there, basically.
Yeah. At this point, almost all the code is in a namespace. Some of it I have nested like two levels deep. And for a while, I was kind of like resistant to doing that because it's kind of like nested routes. Like you don't want to make your routes nested crazily deep because then you're just going nuts. And so I wanted to have like one namespace level deep. But after a while, everything started getting so complicated and voluminous that it made sense to put namespaces inside of namespaces. And it's actually fine. And if you pay attention to the Rails code, it does that too. Like totally. You'll see multiple of the double colons in a lot of the class names.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? Just to completely do a left turn all of a sudden, what if you do like time.now.class? Oh, that's not a good example because that is just the time class, completely unqualified. Okay. But what if you do the time.zoned? Okay, here's not a great example, but time.zone.now.class is active support time with zone.
Right. Yeah.
And to go back to a much earlier point, I think that's a great example of a class name that would take kind of a lot of imagination to come up with. This class is called Time with Zone. That's much different from like these examples of classes called engine and car and stuff like that, where it's just like you're just taking objects in the world and making them objects. I don't think that's really the way, you know, sometimes that happens. Like I have a class called charge because our patients get charged, and so there's a charge object. Sometimes you have that, but those are like the very root
run
objects.
Out of those names.
What's that?
Right, you run out of simple names because you're like, I need four classes to describe this concept, and so I gotta have to start being specific. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think like sometimes when you create objects, you're just using a concept that already exists, but sometimes, a lot of times, you have to invent a concept in order to make an object. Do you find that to be the case too?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I don't know that I would think of it as an inventing, but more like really isolating the most minimal version of some concept, like the refundable deposits thing we were talking about. Well, in my app, not all deposits are refundable. So what are we going to call those that are? Whew, refundable deposits. Cool. But what if like some of those, let's say you couldn't refund the entire deposit. Let's say some business rule says some of them you can only refund half of it. Well, then it would be partially refundable deposits or something like that. You have to keep getting specific so that you can have a name for these things.
Yeah. Yeah. And like this time with zone example again, like if I said, hey, Dave, what time is it? 11:50 a.m. Oh, no. What time with zone is it? Is what I mean. Like nobody says what time with zone is it. They had to just invent that concept in order to have the class.
Totally. Well, and the other cool thing about that, so there's a thing you can do in Ruby, which is like you can take a way to implement this time with zone thing would have been to like get the time object returned and like add a bunch of methods to it, to that object only. And then you're looking at the class called time, but it has all these magical methods on it. So they didn't do that, right? They made time with zone. And the cool thing about that is you have a name that you can then go look up and see what it does. So if I'm in like, I don't know, we're really making stuff up about time with zone, but let's say that sometimes you call time with zone and it returns something else, like time without zone, let's just say. And then you can look at the class of what you got, and it's got a name that you can go look up and find out like what it does. And that's nice. That is, you know, coming back to the how do I know what the code is doing? Like it is nice to be able to look at the class name of a thing so you can figure out like what the code is doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've ended up with objects all over my code base that are like these weird class names because it's a concept that I had to totally come up with out of thin air. Yeah. But I think it really aids the understandability.
Yeah.
We're getting close to time here. But what I think I want to do is, I'll talk to you about this after the show, but I want to get your book because for some reason I haven't gotten that yet. And then I'll invite you back on to talk about some of the stuff in there because, you more than a lot of other people I've talked to, it's just great to talk with you about these concepts because you have such a richness of experience and our opinions, have a lot of overlap in these areas, but they're not identical. And so we can have a little back and forth about like, oh, I do it this way, but you do it this way. Why do you do it that way? So what I'm trying to say is that this has been a really great conversation.
Yeah, definitely. To briefly hype the book, there is a chapter in there that explains this concept of like not putting business logic in active records. That's actually you can download for free. But there's also a chapter where it goes through a more substantial example of like, what does it look like to have the business logic out? And like, it's not like I would say like super complicated, but it's more complicated than you might get in your average like intro to Rails book. Because the idea was like, okay, I can't share with you the app that I'm working on because it's private, but let me write something a little bit substantial to see like what it kind of feels like. So there's a chapter in there that you can just see all of that. And I make no apologies for things like widget creator.create widget. Like, that's in there and it explains why. But anyway, that's all, you know, in there, which I think helps to see real examples, because it can be, like you said, engine and car and pedal and bike. Like, they only get you so far and like truly understanding some of this stuff. So
I'm curious, as a fellow author and blogger and stuff like that, what was your impetus for writing this book? For me, it's like, sometimes it's, I look at the apps that I work on and I think like, oh, this certain thing has been an issue in like all these different apps, and I really wish people knew about this, or something like that. Like, what triggered you to write this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the ones that I've written, including this, are like, okay, I have this experience that I just went through, and I have this knowledge that I think would be useful to other people. How can I like impart this? And I was listening to a podcast with Dave Thomas and Andy Hunt. Yes, Andy Hunt. They were talking about the Pragmatic Programmer, like 20th anniversary or something. And they talked about how like writing a book, even though it seems weird in this day and age, it's a way to really kind of crystallize your thinking, because you're, like you were saying before, if you write it out and write it in a kind of long form, you can really get your idea like really crystallized. So that was kind of it. It was like, all right, I've got all this knowledge. I want to write it down and you know, let other people like look at it, because I think it would be useful. And I'm not gonna be able to do that in a bunch of blog posts. So,
Yeah. Very similar to me. Like, I'm working on a book right now that I'm calling, very creatively, I'm calling it the Rails Testing Book. But that's like, you know, you can write things in blog posts, but sometimes you just need to have like a big, long, cohesive body to really be able to communicate stuff. And a lot of like this stuff that you're writing about, it's so like nuanced that like it really, for better or worse, yeah, takes like a lot of explaining in order to really convey the ideas.
Yeah. And you have to, at least for me, I like to see like when we're discussing an idea, like when does this not work? When should you not do this? Or when, like, cause there's no way of programming that like always works everywhere. Like, there's always a place to like not do some quote unquote best practice. And so I feel like a book is a good way to say, okay, like you said, you're building up this holistic example, and then you can really get into the nuance of like, we could do this, but that's not right. That's not right in this case. Here's when you don't want to use this. Here's when you do want to do this. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, great. Dear listener, you should go check out Dave's book. It's called Sustainable Web Development with Ruby on Rails. I just Googled sustainable Rails and it came right up. So you should be able to find it easily. Cool. And then, of course, we will put it in the show notes as well. Dave, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. It was good.